All right, everyone, welcome back. Today, we're going deep, like really deep, into this idea of legal appeals and specifically, what happens when someone pleads guilty? Can they still go back and fight about things that happened way earlier in the case? You know, like before they even said guilty? We're focusing on this New York case, People v. Scott Hansen, and it really gets into some fascinating territory about the limits of appeals.
Yeah, it's a crucial area for anyone who wants to really understand how the legal system functions, especially the concept that, you know, decisions like a guilty plea have consequences that ripple outward. It's this intersection between plea bargains, which often seem like the end of the line, and potential issues or errors that might have cropped up back in the grand jury phase long before a plea is even on the table.
That's it, exactly. You hit the nail on the head. So the fundamental question, the one we're wrestling with today is, if you plead guilty, if you say, I did it, does that basically wipe the slate clean? Does it mean you can't then go back and argue about whether the case should have even gone forward in the first place? And that's where Hansen comes in. To set the scene, we need to rewind all the way back to 1998 when the initial indictment came down.
Okay, so the initial situation. We've got Scott Hansen, and he's facing some pretty serious charges, multiple felonies, burglary in the first degree, attempted burglary in the second degree, assault in the second degree. This all stemmed from an encounter he had with a man named Harold Stickney.
Right. And the grand jury, and just as a quick reminder for our listeners, the grand jury's job is to decide whether there's even enough evidence to formally charge someone with a crime they heard testimony from Stickney. He described Hansen trying to break into his home, forcing his way in, and a fight that ensued. And of course, the grand jury also heard from law enforcement. A deputy Stark testified that when he questioned Hansen, Hansen said he was simply outside, you know, shoveling snow.
But then the plot thickens, right? Because we have Hansen's own testimony before the grand jury, and he paints a very different picture. He tells them that he was high at the time of the incident, heavily under the influence of drugs, that he was having hallucinations, and that because of all of this, he honestly believed that Stickney was armed with a gun. So very different accounts of what went down.
And here's where it gets really, really interesting and where the core of the legal challenge arises. Before Hansen even got the chance to give his version of events to the grand jury, the prosecutor did something unusual. They decided to show the grand jury a videotaped news report about the incident. But here's the thing. This wasn't direct evidence from the scene or from witnesses. It was basically a reporter summarizing their understanding of what happened, so it contained a lot of hearsay, secondhand information, potentially unreliable stuff. And this is where Hansen's lawyers really jumped in, arguing that this media narrative, this outside information, had tainted the grand jury's decision-making process, that it had prejudiced them against Hansen.
It's a really important point to raise. I mean, the whole purpose of a grand jury proceeding is to have that body evaluate the evidence presented directly to them in that room, not to have them be swayed by external narratives or media spin. So Hansen's legal team was basically saying, look, this wasn't a fair process. They filed a motion to dismiss the whole indictment because of it.
But the trial court wasn't convinced. They denied Hansen's request to throw out the indictment. And what did Hansen do? Faced with these charges, he ultimately decided to plead guilty, but to a slightly lesser charge than the original one's attempted burglary in the first degree.
And that plea, that decision to plead guilty, leads us to the central question that this entire case is about. Could Hansen, after saying, okay, I'm guilty, still appeal the issue of what happened during those grand jury proceedings? Specifically, could he still argue that showing that news report was a major error that should have invalidated everything?
This gets into the concept of appellate forfeiture, which is kind of a legal mouthful, but it basically means you give up certain rights to appeal when you plead guilty. In Hansen's case, the appellate division, which is the intermediate appeals court in New York, ruled that, yep, by pleading guilty, he had essentially waived or forfeited his right to appeal that specific grand jury issue. So let's really break down this concept of a guilty plea and all the implications it carries, because it's not a simple thing. It's a big decision. Generally, in New York law, once a defendant formally says, I'm guilty, that's usually considered the end of the road for their criminal case. It's a legal admission, a formal acknowledgement of guilt, and typically brings the whole process to a close.
That's right. Finality is a huge value in the legal system. Courts want to see disputes resolved, and guilty pleas do that in a very clear-cut way. But, and this is crucial to understand, there are some very specific, very limited exceptions to this general rule. These exceptions usually involve things called jurisdictional defects. Think of it like this. If the crime actually happened in a totally different state, then the New York court never had the authority to handle the case in the first place, or situations where fundamental constitutional rights have been violated. Classic examples of those are if a defendant was coerced into pleading guilty, like under extreme pressure or threats, or if they were denied their right to have a lawyer represent them throughout the proceedings. Those are serious issues that can derail the whole concept of a fair trial.
And in Hansen's situation, his lawyers were trying to argue that showing that videotape to the grand jury was a violation of his right to due process, which is definitely a constitutional argument. But as we've seen, the court didn't buy it. They didn't see it as one of those fundamental game-changing exceptions that would allow him to appeal after pleading guilty.
Exactly. And this takes us straight to the Court of Appeals, which is New York's highest court, the final word on matters of state law. Their decision in the Hansen case really solidified how this whole idea of appellate forfeiture works in cases like his. Chief Judge Kaye wrote the majority opinion, and she made it crystal clear that, in their view, guilty pleas are meant to bring a criminal case to a definitive end.
There's a really powerful quote from her opinion that sums up their stance perfectly. She wrote, "A plea of guilty marks the end of a criminal case, not a gateway to further litigation." So no mincing words there. What was their reasoning for taking such a strong position on the finality of guilty pleas?
They essentially said that for something to be appealable after a guilty plea, for it to really survive that plea, it has to be an error so serious that it fundamentally undermines the integrity of the process itself. And when they talk about the integrity of the process, they're talking about the very foundation of fairness and legitimacy in the entire case. Not just a mistake here or there with a piece of evidence. They're talking about huge systemic issues like racial bias infecting jury selection, or if the initial arrest was made without any probable cause whatsoever, meaning the whole case was built on shaky ground from the very beginning. Those are the kinds of errors that call into question whether justice was even possible in that case.
So they drew a bright line, a clear distinction between those kinds of foundational errors and what they saw as mere evidentiary errors. That's how they categorize the prosecutor showing the videotape. A mistake, maybe even a bad one, but not a fundamental threat to the system as a whole.
Exactly right. And the court went on to explain that, in their view, once you plead guilty, you can no longer challenge the sufficiency of the evidence that was presented to the grand jury. That's essentially what Hansen was trying to do by arguing that the videotape tainted the grand jury's decision. And their reasoning for this likely took into account that even if you totally disregard the videotape, even if you say it shouldn't have been shown, there was other evidence that the grand jury had in front of them.
And what was that other evidence? Well, you've got Harold Stickney's firsthand account, his direct testimony about the attempted break-in and the struggle that ensued. You also have Hansen's own statements to Deputy Stark, where he claimed he was just outside shoveling snow, a statement that directly contradicts what he later told the grand jury. It's worth pointing out, for our legally-minded listeners, the distinction here. The reporter's account in the newscast would probably be considered inadmissible hearsay. You can't just bring in someone's secondhand summary of events. But Hansen's own previous statement to the deputy, the one that doesn't match up with his later testimony, that could be admissible as a statement against his own interest, as a party admission.
That's a key difference, a legal nuance that really matters. So the court's likely thinking was, even if you completely discount the videotape, even if you throw it out, there was still enough other admissible evidence presented to the grand jury for them to have rightfully invited Hansen. And all of this feeds into the broader finality doctrine in the context of plea bargains. The justice system really wants these agreements to stick. It wants them to provide closure and not be subject to endless challenges and appeals based on what might be seen as smaller, less consequential errors that happened in the earlier stages of the case.
Okay, so let's shift gears a bit and think about the practical takeaways from the Hansen case. What should our listeners, who are hopefully fascinated by all these legal twists and turns, really take away from this decision? What are the lasting implications?
Well, for any defense attorneys out there listening, People v. Hansen is a major case to have in your mental toolbox. It really underscores how important it is to thoroughly advise your clients about everything that a guilty plea entails, all the potential consequences, the good and the bad. And a big part of that is making it crystal clear that by pleading guilty, they are likely waiving, giving up their right to challenge many of the things that might have happened pre-trial, including potential problems or errors that occurred during the grand jury proceedings. It's a trade-off that needs to be carefully considered.
It also highlights just how narrow the grounds for appeal become once that guilty plea is entered. we're really talking about a limited set of options. There's fundamental jurisdictional issues, like whether the court had the authority to hear the case at all, or truly core constitutional violations that go directly to the heart of the plea itself.
Think of things like if the defendant was denied effective assistance of counsel, meaning their lawyer wasn't up to par, during the plea negotiations. That kind of error could potentially survive a guilty plea. And, you know, as we've talked about, the line between what the courts consider a fundamental defect, something serious enough to potentially overturn a guilty plea, and a more technical or procedural error is really important, but can also be incredibly tricky. It's a nuanced distinction. I mean, to go back to that example from our prep materials, if a prosecutor straight up lied to the grand jury to get an indictment, that's a huge breach of trust, a real attack on the integrity of the system. That kind of misconduct might be viewed as so egregious that it could be appealed even after a guilty plea. But something like a mistake with admitting hearsay evidence, as in Hansen's case, well, that's much less likely to clear that high bar.
So for you, the listener, understanding all of this comes down to recognizing that a guilty plea is a strategic decision. It's a pivotal moment in the case. In Hansen's situation, he basically made a choice. He gave up the possibility of appealing that videotape issue in exchange for pleading guilty to a less serious charge, attempted burglary, instead of the more serious charges he was originally facing. It's a calculated risk, a gamble, and it has lasting repercussions.
Exactly. And that potential trade-off, that balance of risks and benefits, is something that anyone facing criminal charges needs to grasp fully, especially if they're considering entering into a plea agreement. It's not a decision to make lightly.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into People v. Scott Hansen, the big takeaways are pretty clear. Guilty pleas are big deals. They have major consequences. And one of the biggest is how they limit your ability to go back and challenge things that happened earlier in the case before you entered that plea. There are almost always trade-offs at play when a defendant decides to plead guilty, and those need to be carefully weighed.
This case really emphasizes how crucial it is for defense attorneys to be thorough, to be thoughtful, and to really lay out all of these implications for their clients before those clients make a decision as weighty and potentially final as a guilty plea. It's about informed consent, about making sure the defendant understands the full picture.
And from the prosecutor's side, the Hansen case kind of reinforces the value of having a system that aims for finality. Plea bargains, when done properly, can help the system work efficiently and bring cases to a close. But on the flip side, it also reminds prosecutors that they have a duty to conduct themselves ethically, to avoid serious misconduct that could taint the entire process, even if a defendant ultimately chooses to plead guilty. Fairness has to be present at every stage.
At the end of the day, People v. Hansen is a landmark case for understanding this concept of appellate forfeiture, particularly in the context of guilty pleas and how those interact with grand jury proceedings. It clarifies what rights defendants usually give up when they decide to plead guilty, what issues are essentially off the table once that plea is entered.
And that brings us to a final thought-provoking question for all of you listening out there. In a legal system that ideally strives for both efficiency and fairness, how do we strike the right balance? How do we uphold the principle of finality, the idea that legal proceedings should have a clear endpoint, while also ensuring that every stage of a criminal case, from the very beginning, even before a guilty plea enters the picture, is conducted in a fair and just manner? It's a question that goes to the heart of how our justice system functions, how we balance competing values, and it's something worth pondering as we navigate this complex legal terrain. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.